World War II. My 6'3" father towered over me, holding the family globe of the world. I was 7 years old on this cloudy, winter day in Iowa, with neither plans nor inspiration for a lazy Sunday afternoon. With a hearing loss that almost sent me to Iowa's school for the deaf, I lay on the maroon carpet in my new home, head buried in the speaker on our Sears Silvertone console, with its AM and shortwave radio and automatic 78 RPM record changer and player. It was December 7, 1941, and the announcer was talking about the Japanese warplane's attack on the Pearl Harbor Navy base on the Hawaiian island of Oahu. Dad looked down to judge my mood, and then sat on the floor beside me. Holding the globe in his lap, he placed the index finger of his left hand on Oahu, the index finger of his right hand on Iowa. It was his way of reassuring me that the war was far away, and that I was safe, though at that moment his concern probably far exceeded my own. After all, war, especially inside America, was far beyond my experience or even my imagination. He, by contrast, lived through the build-up to World War I, 1914 to 1918, and would have been 12 when American soldiers entered Europe during the last few weeks of that war, prior to the armistice, November 11, 1918. What we would both come to share was the impact of war on young boys, he from age 8 to 12, I from age 7 to 11. Wars, even world wars, were much shorter then. War has its most devastating impact on the children who live and die during wars they do not want, did not start, and do not understand. Sometimes adults force them to engage in battle. Often they lose family members and friends. Almost always they suffer life-changing emotional harm along with their physical wounds. But the existence of wars impacts all children in a variety of ways. They may have fears and nightmares, however irrational, that they may soon be in danger. Fear is certainly not eased by drills in school involving ducking under desks or seeking other safe places in case of attack. They may know someone or hear talk of named individuals who are in the military. Before moving to the family home in the Iowa City Melrose neighborhood in the summer of 1941, we lived in the Brown Street House, a large, mid-19th century brick home on the National Register of Historic Places we shared with another family. Exploring the house one day, I went to the attic for the first time to look around. Much to my surprise, there was evidence someone was living there: a thin mattress and blanket on the floor, a couple college textbooks, and a box of Nabisco soda crackers. My parents did not seem alarmed at my revelation of this intruder. I simply accepted, like Poet Hugh's Means Antigonish character, that I had simply met a man who wasn't there. Later, during WW2, they told me only that his name was Bruce Hill, and that he had fought and died in the Pacific Theater. Imagine, a civilian economy supporting 132 million Americans, as the U.S. then was, that had to be turned on a dime into a war economy. Taxi drivers were drafted and trained to be soldiers driving jeeps. Auto workers stopped making trucks and started making tanks. Rosie the Riveter symbolized the 19 million women who went to work in munitions factories and the shipyards where they built 6,000 cargo ships, the survivors of which were in the reserve fleets that became my responsibility 20 years later. Everyone, including us kids, were involved in the war effort. Rather than fund the costs of war with a credit card and increasing debt, much of the money was raised in advance with a victory tax and the sale of war bonds. Children came to school with coins and their little paper war savings bonds albums, filled with stamps representing each 10-cent purchase. When we'd licked enough stamps to total $18.75, we could purchase a war bond worth $25 years later. Everything useful to the military was rationed, such as food, gasoline, and rubber tires. The necessary ration coupons were as valuable as money in acquiring a family's share of limited resources. But even ration coupons were not enough to buy bubbly gum, one of the many sacrifices we were willing, if not happy, to make for the war effort. To save gasoline, we walked and biked more, rather than being driven around. And we dug, planted, and maintained victory gardens in the shape of the letter V to help provide food for our families. We gathered the apples that Dad turned into cider, and Mother made into applesauce among the many foods she canned in mason jars for the winter. I took care of the chickens that provided our eggs. Recycling was not just a nice idea, it was an added source of material for war. Bacon fat was saved in old tin cans that we took to the Redemption Center to be used in making bombs. Those of us who were Cub Scouts rode on the trucks picking up newspapers for recycling. Tinfoil collection was assigned to the young, first separating it from the wrapping on chewing gum and cigarette packs. There was undeveloped land around the Melrose neighborhood in those days, including across the street from our house. Greenwood Drive, connecting Melrose Court with Benton Street, was then a dirt road, as it had been for the previous 100 years. After it crossed the Rock Island Railroad tracks, there was nothing but farmland and Melrose Lake, suitable for ice skating in the winter when we could remember how to get to it. Most important, north of some of the homes a block east of where Melrose Court joined Myrtle Avenue was a densely forested ravine. Why was that important? Because it was common during WW2 for children across America to switch from playing cowboys and Indians to playing war. We would choose sides, use a broken tree limb or broomstick handle for our rifle, and go after the enemy in maneuvers more resembling the Revolutionary War than WW2. Thankfully, not only did the children of the Melrose neighborhood not experience the true horror of actual battle, we did not even need to play war. The war came to us. Actually, what came to us was not really the war. It was a manifestation of the United States' preparations for that war. Established two blocks from our homes was one of the five U.S. Navy pre-flight training schools. These schools, set up on university campuses, were one stage of the Navy's rigorous program for turning civilians into fighter pilots. The training combined physical fitness with book learning and other skills. It also included the welcoming of curious young boys and girls. An obstacle course was created that, of course, we loved to run in the early evenings when it was not being used by naval cadets. There was a wall and a cargo net to be climbed, a rope that could carry you over a water pit unless you didn't hang on, things to jump over, and crawl under a young boy's delight. A comic book depicting a soldier using vines around his feet to help him climb a Pacific Island palm tree inspired me to try to climb the telephone pole on our property using cloth line instead of vines. While I made it almost to the top, I knew enough not to hang on to power lines for support. Cloth line, our equivalent of today's duct tape, was a near-universal solution to the day's challenges. I also used it to wrap around my rear bicycle tire in winter as what proved to be an ineffective bicycle version of car chains. I never followed along on the 20-mile hikes, but Jerry Holland did. He was the older brother of Patty, who was near my age, and Annie, who was my sister Kate's age. As it happened, John Glenn, the astronaut and senator, was one of the cadets who Jerry came to know and who subsequently played a role in Jerry's acceptance into Annapolis. Ultimately, Jerry retired from the Navy with the rank of Admiral. My first introduction to Morse code, which took the form of an amateur radio operator's license 30 years later, came in the training sessions for cadets in the attic of the university's engineering building. The university's field house, combination swimming pool, basketball court, ROTC armory, and auditorium for graduations, was just across the street from our neighborhood. Hanging from its hallway ceiling were unmarked, small, coal-black models of Japanese and American fighter planes for cadets to practice accurate identification. Immediately south of the field house on the west end of the asphalt tennis courts, sometimes used as a parking lot, was a full-scale wooden model of a ship's deck and bridge. When cadets said they were ill, they were required to stand there with semaphore flags, communicating with an instructor standing on the ship. My recollection is that my interest in this form of communication resulted in my being presented with a pair of those flags and an invitation to participate in that training. Across the street to the east from the semaphore training was a building that housed the program's director, Captain Hanrahan. He kept a map of Europe on his wall, where a constantly updated string indicated the front line's movement east. He said we were welcome to visit him to check up on the progress of the war. During the last year of World War I, U.S. Senator Hiram W. Johnson, R. California. he's purported to have observed, the first casualty when war comes is truth. What we today call fake news or alternative facts during wartime is referred to as propaganda. Indeed, after WW2, the subject matter called general semantics was propelled by awareness of propaganda's powerful potential for evil when wielded in the past by Hitler or in the future by other authoritarian leaders. One of the major purposes of wartime propaganda is the building of popular support for the war by vilifying what a nation's leaders characterize as its enemies. The process was captured in a Richard Rodgers song from the musical, South Pacific, You've Got to Be Carefully Taught, with the lines, You've got to be taught before it's too late, before you are 6 or 7 or 8 to hate all the people your relatives hate, you've got to be carefully taught. Sadly, though perhaps necessary in wartime, the U.S. had its own propaganda program. Those creating motion pictures, radio programs, songs, comic books, and news stories were encouraged to, and did, support the war effort. They endeavored to keep up Americans' spirits with the good news, and make sure we were carefully taught to hate the Germans and Japanese. I recall a poster on a building in downtown Iowa City, with an unflattering depiction of a Japanese soldier viciously attacking one of ours. By 1945, the war was over. So now what? The rebuilding began. The U.S. Marshall Plan provided over $130 billion in inflation-adjusted dollars to help rebuild the economies of countries that suffered severe destruction from the war. But recovery from a war requires a good bit of human recovery as well. Many of those military men and women who lived to return brought back physical and emotional wounds with them, sometimes to last the rest of their lives. Reuniting families did not always go smoothly. The GI Bill provided veterans low-cost mortgages, other loans, and was best known for the program providing free tuition and living expenses for college and other education. The University of Iowa campus that had played a role in training men and women for battle during the war began training them for the roles they would play in one of the nation's greatest periods of economic expansion. But what of the children who had been taught to hate? What were children to do with their hatred of Germans and Japanese? My own grandfather had immigrated to this country from Germany. Many of my Iowa friends and neighbors had German heritage after all. Germans were the second largest immigrant group throughout Iowa's 99 counties. I made a visit to my grandfather Max's home, Berg auf Fehmarn, on the German island of Fehmarn. Because his father had made rope line for ships, and his grandfather was a ship captain who had died in a storm off the coast of Fehmarn, the island was also of interest to me as a former maritime administrator. Moreover, the second oldest church on the island, St. Nikolai Kirke, built about 1230, was named for St. Nicholas, no relation, the patron saint of sea travelers. Of perhaps greater interest to music fans, Fehmarn was the location of Jimi Hendrix's last concert, the Open Air Love and Peace Festival, September 6, 1970. In George Orwell's book, 1984, he describes how state propaganda was used to explain to the citizens why countries once thought to be friendly had somehow become enemies, and how countries once enemies were now allies. So it was for Americans after WW2. The Germany that my Aunt Joel Rayburn affectionately referred to as the old country had become our nation's enemy during WW2, only to become one of our strongest economic and NATO allies after that war. This was dramatized for me during a visit to Germany during my bachelor years to see a woman I had come to know when she was studying in Washington as a Fulbright scholar. One of the many things we had in common was our German heritage. On a trip to Berlin, where we passed through the Berlin Wall under the watchful eyes of East German military, we paused to view a burial site that held some 10,000 Russian soldiers. Those soldiers had been America's allies when they were killed, but we were now engaged in a Cold War with the Soviet Union, so on the day of our visit Russian soldiers would be our enemy. I was standing there with a woman whose father had been part of the Nazi military, very much our enemy, until captured and held by the Russians. The Germans then our enemy and now our partners were the ones who killed those 10,000 Russians, then our allies, now our enemy. My head was spinning. What was I thinking? What should I have been thinking? I couldn't make sense of it. What I did know was that I felt no less affection for my companion, and that perhaps, just perhaps, the whole experience had helped to put behind me what I had been carefully taught to hate about Germans. Japan offered the same challenge. How could I rid myself of the hatred I'd been taught? Our family had no ties to Japan. No family members, not even photos from a visit. The first and only Japanese person I knew as a child was Dad's general semantics friend and colleague Don Hayakawa, whom I probably never met until after the war. My first two presidential appointments, maritime administrator and FCC commissioner, required travel to Japan, and I seized the opportunity to cleanse my soul of any remnants of anti-Japanese propaganda. I learned a few Japanese phrases, insisted the embassy put me up in ryokans, traditional Japanese inns, rather than high-rise Hilton hotels and the like, ate Japanese food, and arranged to meet with Japanese young people as well as the public officials and business representatives. Ultimately, I felt myself fully cleansed, and Mary and I now have permanent good friends in Japan. I had finally put WW2 behind me. Of course, I have yet to go through this process in the 15 or more additional countries in which we have fought wars in the years since WW2, a subject addressed in the appendix to this chapter which follows. Appendix. So far as I know, neither side of my family has a strong military tradition. The oral history suggests my grandfather on Dad's side came from Sweden because of the poor economy at the time. My mother's father came from Germany, perhaps in part to avoid conscription. Dad was too young to fight in World War I and old enough to avoid WW2. My sons were too young for Vietnam and did not later choose to volunteer for military careers. As maritime administrator, 1964 to 1966, I had some responsibility for sea lift to Vietnam, working with the Pentagon and visiting the agency's MARAID office in Saigon. My rank was considered the equivalent of an admiral, and in prior years had carried the additional title of director, warshipping authority. However, while my MARAID service provided valuable experience with the military, it was not military service. Wars were shorter then. American soldiers were fighting in WWI for less than a year. WW2 in Europe is said to have begun with Hitler's invasion of Poland in September of 1939. The US provided support, but American troops didn't land in Europe D-Day until June 6, 1944 and declared victory May 8, 1945 VE-Day, just under 1 year. WW2 in the Pacific Theater began December 7, 1941, when Japan bombed Pearl Harbor along with attacks on Thailand, Malaya, Singapore and Hong Kong the same day and ended with the Japanese surrender on August 14, 1945 a little over 3.5 years. Of course, the war involved many other countries and theaters of war, in Africa and elsewhere. There was a reason it was called a world war. That's not to say these relatively short wars were easy. Altogether, over 1 million American military were killed or wounded during WW2, a number that needs to be multiplied by all who experienced hardship during their absence, and grief upon their failure to return whole, if at all. But we must apparently now deal with the impact of perpetual war. Following the attack on the Twin Towers in New York City on September 11, 2001, the U.S. began our never-ending military action in Afghanistan on October 7, 2001. In 2017, President Trump was sending still more troops. You do the math. We spend more on our military than the next 10 nations combined to, among other things, maintain a military presence in roughly 150 countries. In addition to the wars in Afghanistan, Korea and Vietnam, we have also conducted military operations since WW2 in Bosnia, Cuba, Dominican Republic, Grenada, Gulf War, 1991, Haiti, Iraq, Kosovo, Lebanon, Panama, Somalia and Syria, among others. Couple that with the Defense Department's overwhelming share of the federal budget, and the potential availability of the National Guard for domestic disturbances and disasters, and it is difficult to deny that America contains many of the elements of an actual and potential military state.